When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountainside. After he had sat down, his disciples gathered around him, and he began to teach them. How blessed are the poor in spirit. The reign of God is theirs. Blessed too are the sorrowing. They shall be consoled. Blessed are the lowly. They shall inherit the land. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for holiness. They shall have their fill. Blessed are they who show mercy. Mercy shall be theirs. Blessed are the single-hearted, for they shall see God. Blessed too the peacemakers. They shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those persecuted for holiness' sake. The reign of God is theirs. Blessed are you when they insult you and persecute you and utter every kind of slander against you because of me. Be glad and rejoice, for your reward in heaven is great.
If there is any passage of the New Testament which could be called Christ's manifesto, it's surely the one we've just heard. It's so familiar to us that revolutionary seems an exaggerated description. And yet this program for a new way of living was more subversive than anything Marx could have dreamed of. Nor did Jesus sit quietly writing down his ideas in the seclusion of the reading room of a great library. On the contrary, he proclaimed them from a hilltop. Or so Matthew writes. Luke suggests that he had come down onto the plain. But let's go back a bit in time to the previous night.
Now it was about this time that he went out into the hills to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. When day came, he summoned his disciples and picked out 12 of them. He called them apostles. He then came down with them and stopped at a piece of level ground where there was a large gathering of his disciples with a great crowd of people from all parts of Judea and from Jerusalem and from the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon.
As usual then, with the evangelists, we have an event recounted as happening in two different places, up on a hill, down on the plain. Perhaps if our Lord had been a Greek and lived in ancient times, he would have stood in the theatre at Epidaurus, where you can be heard by the whole audience, even those sitting right at the top, what we'd call the gallery, and he wouldn't have needed to raise his voice. But not only do Luke and Matthew set the scene differently, they also precede what we know as the Sermon on the Mount with different events. While Luke recounts the choosing of the 12 as taking place immediately before, Matthew only has Peter, Andrew, James and John called from their fishing. Finally, the Beatitudes themselves are presented differently by the two writers. But neither the place nor the order of events matters to our evangelists. Only what Jesus said or did. And as for the order in which he said things, this too is irrelevant. St. Augustine puts it best.
Anyone can see, there's no point in asking in what order our Lord uttered these words, for we cannot fail to discover, on the most excellent authority, that of the evangelists themselves, that there is no failure of truth in giving a sermon in an order different from that in which it was first uttered. Whether the order was thus or thus makes no difference to the substance of what was said.
In the year 1187 AD, the Second Crusade, preached by St. Bernard, ended in failure when the Muslim Saladin captured Jerusalem, defeating the Crusaders on the mountain known as the Horns of Hattin. Situated to the west of the Sea of Galilee, or Lake of Tiberias, and rising to about 1,000 feet, it was, the Crusaders believed, where Jesus had preached the Beatitudes. But the shrine which stands on the Mount of the Beatitudes is not there, but further north. And as we read in the guidebook,
from it one can enjoy on the Lake of Tiberias one of the most wonderful views in Galilee. On the right it dominates the town of Tiberias, and below, at the foot of the shrine, there is Tabgha, with the shrine of the multiplication of loaves, and the shrine which commemorates the conferring of the primacy of Peter after the resurrection.
In 1964, Pope Paul VI came to the chapel at Tabgha, built over the rock where the first pope received the keys of the kingdom. Where the Sermon on the Mount was given, we have seen, is unimportant, but Jesuit Father Peter Rieger notes,
the mountain is mentioned since it's a parallel to the original mountain of Mount Sinai, where the first law was given to the chosen people. Christ is here represented as the new Moses, who gives the perfect law of the gospel. The crowds are not only Jews, but also people from Syria and the surrounding regions, which presumably includes pagans. Thus, the future universal nature of the missionary vocation of the disciples to all peoples is here implied. Through the disciples, Christ addresses himself to the whole world.
And now, before we leave the image of hill or mount to consider the Beatitudes themselves, let's listen to these lines by the Dutch artist Jan de Foe, based on an ancient poem known as the Song of Amergin. The theme is contemporary, that everyone should pay respect to and take responsibility for the environment they inhabit. The manuscript of the original poem, said to date back to 1268 BC, is in the library of the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin.
I am a hill where poets walk, mountain surrounded by dancing signs, words, lines of dreams, unspoken in daily happening, past and future intertwined, wild ranks of ever-growing green, reaching outward, down and upward, seeking the sounds of birds singing in the cold of winter's night.
Many interpretations have been given to the Beatitudes, many the explanations of their meaning and message. None can be definitive. So I've made an arbitrary choice of the thoughts of a few people on some of the Beatitudes. First, we should perhaps define Beatitude itself. Supreme blessedness, perfect felicity, say the dictionaries. And this, which seems to come closest, the special blessedness announced in the Sermon on the Mount. Special indeed, above all, in its total unexpectedness. The first of the Beatitudes is probably also the most discussed. How blessed or how happy are the poor in spirit? But, writes Carlo Carretto,
who can claim to be poor in the biblical sense? The man who comes to understand, under the pressure of suffering or in the light of God, what it means to be human. The man who discovers his own limitations, who enters into the mystery of what it means to be a creature rather than a creator. Anyone, that is, who knows he is sick, small, weak, vulnerable, ignorant, sinful, needful of everything, who stands at the mercy of history and of wickedness in high places. Prisoner of hostile circumstances, who has learnt humility and discretion from the pain and anguish of his experience, who is thirsting for help and for love. The poor man, in short, is the man who has discovered his own limitations. He is blessed, and he becomes blessed, if he accepts such limitations as coming to him from the hand of God, in order that the kingdom might become a reality within him.
Few people can have been so close to the poor as Mother Teresa, now blessed in more ways than one. In 1982, after frequent meetings with Mother Teresa in Rome and in Calcutta, Sean Patrick Lovett compiled a book of her meditations. Here, in an exclusive and historic recording, are her thoughts on "Happy the pure in heart, they shall see God." In the version we heard today, "Blessed are the single-hearted," but somehow the word "pure" has a force all its own.
A pure heart is a heart that serves, a pure heart that is free to give, to love until it hurts. A pure heart can easily see Christ in the hungry, in the naked, in the homeless, in the lonely, in the unwanted, in the unloved, in the leper, in the alcoholic, the man lying in the street, unwanted, unloved, hungry. Because there is not only hunger for bread, there is hunger for love. There is not only nakedness for a piece of cloth, but there is that nakedness for that human dignity. It's not only homelessness for a small house to live in, but that homelessness of being abandoned by all, unwanted, unloved, uncared, having forgotten what is human love, what is human joy, what is human touch.
Blessed, too, are the sorrowing. They shall be consoled. A brief reflection on this theme comes from Andrew Jukes, a 19th century Anglican deacon.
I can tell you for an eternal truth that troubled souls are always safe. It is the untroubled that are in danger. Trouble in itself is always a claim on love, and God is love. He must deny himself if he does not come to help the helpless. It is the prisoners and the blind and the leper and the possessed and the hungry and the tempest-tossed who are his special care. Therefore, if you are lost and sick and bound, you are just in the place where he can meet you. Blessed are the mourners. They shall be comforted.
And what of the peacemakers? Surely they, in our war-torn world, are precious among the blessed. How many of them, though, have been eliminated by the violent? Mahatma Gandhi, Great Soul, 1948. Martin Luther King, 1968. Anwar Sadat, 1981. And in more recent times, Yitzhak Rabin. Back in 1926, Gandhi had written...
Non-violence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our very being.
In his book, Strength to Love, Martin Luther King tells of how he discovered the life and teachings of Gandhi.
I came to see for the first time that the Christian doctrine of love, operating through the Gandhian method of non-violence, is one of the most potent weapons available to an oppressed people in their struggle for freedom.
When the bus boycott began in Montgomery, Alabama, where King had been pastor for a year or so, the people asked him to act as their spokesman.
In accepting this responsibility, my mind, consciously or unconsciously, was driven back to the Sermon on the Mount and the Gandhian method of non-violent resistance. This principle became the guiding light of our movement. Christ furnished the spirit and motivation, and Gandhi furnished the method.
Blessed be the peacemakers, they shall be called sons of God.